Langley Bay.
On the Empire Podcast this week, we chat with Midsummer Murder star John Nettles, is it? Oh, wait, no, I misread that. We talk with the star of Midsummer, which is about murders. Ah, Will Poulter is on the podcast this week. How exciting.
We all were just completely overwhelmed by it.
Yeah.
And all felt sort of wowed and disturbed, kind of in equal measure.
All that, plus usual movie news and nonsense on the movie podcast that is about to go to see The Play That Goes Wrong for the fourth time. Hopefully this time they'll get it right. Because every time I've seen it so far, embarrassing mishaps.
Oh my goodness.
All over the place.
I'm surprised that you've given them that many chances for The Play That Goes Wrong to go right.
I am eternally optimistic. Why do you think it's deliberate?
No, I don't think it could be, could it?
Surely if it goes right, then The Play That Goes Wrong has gone wrong, if nothing
Whoa.
Goes wrong.
If The Play That Goes Wrong going right is wrong, then I never want The Play That Goes Wrong to be right.
Sure.
Anyway, welcome to the podcast that goes wrong. I am Empire's Chris Hewitt, and I'm joined this week by two colleagues of such a lethal cunning. You've already heard them. They couldn't wait. They couldn't wait to be introduced. They have what I call James Dyer-itis, which is you just you insert yourself into the podcast before the folks at home even have the chance to know who the hell you are.
Yeah.
It's podcast etiquette. It's basic podcast etiquette, guys. It kind of is. It kind of is. See, I've introduced myself. The people at home know that I I'm Empire's Chris Hewitt from Empire. Okay? They don't know who you are, Helen O'Hara. Damn it.
Ha ha! Tricked you.
The podcast that goes wrong strikes again.
Yes. I have recently booked tickets to go back and see A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Bridge again.
I am trying to find room in my busy schedule to go see that. My sister and my niece, two separate people, I know we're Northern Irish, but give us credit, are over from Northern Ireland at the moment. So I didn't think they would like Shakespeare, even though my understanding is that there's people cavorting around the stage and stuff.
It's super, super entertaining Shakespeare.
But even so, I think it would have been just too much gobbledygook, which is what Shakespeare wrote, of course.
How dare you.
He specialized in gobbledygook. So I think we decided to go with The Play That Goes Wrong. My sister enjoyed it last year. She guffawed. And so you're going back to
The Play That Goes Wrong and not say the comedy about a bank robbery.
I prefer The Play That Goes Wrong. This feels like a plug for the Mischief Theatre Company.
Yeah, I mean, there are worse things to plug.
Yeah. There are worse things to plug, but they are really, really great. And The Play That Goes Wrong is a play that goes deliberately wrong. The conceit is that it's presented, a murder mystery is presented by an inept amateur dramatics society, and things go wrong.
It's wonderful.
The precision of the comedy is exquisite, and the comedy about a bank robbery has audacious set pieces, but for me, maybe it didn't come together quite as well.
What's that one about?
I should introduce you. Hello, Ben Travis. How are you?
Hello, I'm good, thanks.
Yeah, so the comedy about bank robbery is...
what's that about?
It's really hard to sum up. It's experimental piece about really life and what it means to be human.
Wow. Yeah, also a bank robbery.
Also a bank robbery.
Yeah. Okay.
Mainly a bank robbery.
Mostly a bank robbery.
Anyway, should we move on?
Let's do it.
Oh, hey, Helen.
Hey.
How are you?
Oh, I was in Glastonbury.
You were in Glastonbury.
Yay.
Yes.
I wasn't here last week because I was in Glastonbury. I was working. I'm not somebody who goes to festivals for a week just for fun. I was working in the Pilton Palais film tent. Mm-hmm. It was delightful. And I saw Lizzo and I saw Lauryn Hill and I saw some other people.
That's good.
It was really good.
And if people want to go and see you in the tent, they can go around this weekend and you'll be on from what time?
Four
to five?
I feel bad in saying this, Chris, but the Glastonbury Festival has actually finished for another year.
Wow.
So you have, technically speaking, missed your shot completely.
This might explain why a campsite was so cheap this weekend.
I think that might explain it, yes. Oh. I mean, if it's any consolation, I'm sure the smell lingers on into this week.
We will always have the smell in our hearts. What is the smell like?
It smells like grass.
Does it smell like teen spirit?
Fresh mown grass and teen spirit and a lot of other spirits.
Yes. And a lot of other grass, I presume, as well.
You know what? I did see somebody using drugs in front of me.
At Glastonbury?
I actually clutched my pearls. It was horrendous.
No.
I know.
Ugh.
I did have personally some cheesy garlic bread, which pretty much changed my world.
Did that change your perspective?
Yeah,
on,
it really did. I had tripped out on that cheesy garlic bread. It was
watching
pretty
the
great.
Sunrise at the stone circle with your cheesy garlic bread.
Oh,
did you make a citizen's arrest?
You know what? I tried to alert security, but I was in the middle of the crowd.
They were the ones doing the
No,
anyway,
to be clear, they were not.
Absolutely 110% clear. Anyway, you know those podcasts that go on for ages and ages and ages and ages?
Don't get anywhere?
And don't get anywhere, and then they just ramble and ramble and ramble. Should we have a question?
Sure. Yes.
This question comes from at Jamie Jevs, who says, "Hi guys, I'm getting married on Saturday."
Oh,
hey,
that's nice. Well done.
Congrats.
Thank you. Oh, lovely. Wedding themed pod question. your favorite wedding movies that people normally hate and the ones that you hate that everyone else loves. Now, Jamie, as our present to you and to your wife or husband,
sure.
We're not going to answer your question because it's rubbish. Wait. What we are going to do is we're going to take a part of that question and focus in on that, because I think that's what he really is asking here. What are our favorite wedding movies? And not this convoluted, what are your favorite wedding movies that everyone hates,
sure, sure.
and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So let's go with favorite wedding movies and
okay.
Helen O'Hara,
sure.
go.
Go. I mean, obviously Four Weddings and a Funeral is up there.
Nope.
It is. And
is
also,
it
yes, it
you
is.
You get so much wedding for your money.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
as a wedding movie
it's
goes.
For the price of one, Chris. So
if you go, I've got 10 quid, I want a movie about a wedding, that's £2.50 per wedding.
That's, I mean, you can't say further than that.
And bargain. The funeral checked in
you
there for
would,
free.
You would do well to get a wedding for £2.50, I'll tell you. But also, I'm actually going to say High Society, because I love it and the music is great.
Okay, good.
I mean, The Philadelphia Story is also good, amazing cast, but like High yeah, Society yeah. has better tunes. So.
Why are those two films connected? I don't know quite.
It's so weird that they're together in my head. It's almost like one is a musical remake of the other.
It seems that way, but surely not. Ben?
Seeing as you've mentioned musicals, the one that did spring into my mind was Mamma Mia, because I flipping love Mamma Mia. But
and unironically as well, which is I love
unironically, it's just so much fun. If you've never had a few drinks on a Friday night and watched Mamma Mia with your best friends, then you need to do that as soon as possible. But the thing with Mamma Mia is it's a wedding movie where they don't actually get married at the end.
Spoilers
for Mamma Mia.
Yeah,
but at the end, they're just like, actually, let's not get married while they're in the church. And they spent the whole time singing to get to the church. Mm-hmm. And Meryl Streep has climbed the biggest cliff after shouting at Pierce Brosnan.
Yeah.
And an hour and a half in, they're like, actually, let's sack it off. And they don't break up. They stay together.
Yeah, but they just decide to go just traveling instead. They decide they're too young to get married and they're just going to go travel instead.
Yeah.
It's a very mature decision.
It is. In a film well-renowned for its maturity. So, yeah, I guess it has to be because everything around it is wedding-themed and it's all the ceremony that comes around a wedding except for the wedding itself.
I don't know if that technically counts in that case.
Well, if that doesn't count, then it would be The Wedding Singer.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
Wedding Singer.
Lots of singing.
Yeah.
Lots of weddings.
Lots of weddings.
Again,
actually,
lots of wedding for your money. That's true. You might even get more in that than in
there might be more weddings in The Wedding Singer than Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Some of them are bar mitzvahs, I think.
But there are no funerals.
True. Is that a bonus in your head?
I think it's a bonus. I don't want to go to a funeral. Funerals are boring.
Yeah, they're true.
It's just someone being lowered into the ground. No one wants to see that. But a wedding, that's an affirmation of love.
Sure.
No one gets lowered into the ground in a wedding.
It depends if it's like
experience.
Bride Wars or something, where they very much are at least metaphorically lowered.
Yeah. Helen, you were at my wedding.
I was at your wedding. It was a very good wedding.
You baked our wedding cake.
I did.
Oh, what flavor was it?
It was actually two different flavors.
Ooh.
It was a chocolate cake with chocolate ganache, and then a lemon cake with lemon curd, homemade. And then they were both covered in white chocolate Swiss meringue buttercream.
It sounds tremendous.
And it had Captain America's face on the top?
On the top. Yeah. On the top, yes. And all around the sides, yes.
And where was America's ass?
Well,
nobody saw the bottom of the cake, but it was there.
It was there in our hearts.
It's his day. It's 4th of July.
It's his day.
It is.
We are recording this.
Yeah. So happy birthday to Steve Rogers and to everyone else. And so sorry about that Empire thing. And I don't mean the magazine or the podcast. That's brilliant.
The British
subscribe.
One, you mean.
I mean the British Empire.
Yeah.
And we're sorry about everything that happened. Although it did ultimately lead to Hamilton. So.
Can it really have
bygones?
Been that? Oh boy!
That's all right. We'll call it a draw.
That's a strong argument.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah.
Wow. I mean, I can hear every historian in the world right now screaming. Apart from Jacob Rees-Mogg, who isn't one.
What about Tom Holland?
Oh, Tom Holland would definitely not be with you on that.
Yeah, because if he starts screaming, you wouldn't be able to hear through the Spider-Man mask, for one thing. So
Tom Holland jokes.
Weddings.
Yes.
Weddings.
Ooh, I've got one. It happened one night. She elopes from her wedding at the start.
She does.
And then unelopes at the end, only to re-elope, essentially, the new lover of her life.
Okay, so here we have to define something, all right?
Sure.
So what is a wedding movie? Now, Four Weddings and a Funeral is clearly a wedding movie. The Wedding Singer is clearly a wedding movie. Mm-hmm. Table 19, which came out a couple of years ago.
Wedding movie.
I liked that movie. I gave that 4 stars. I would recommend that. It is a really, really strong movie. And that takes place entirely at a wedding. Mm. Right, you get married?
really good wedding movie. The Wedding Planner, I think, is genuinely a massively underrated wedding movie. As rom-coms go, as classic rom-coms go, that is a superb classic rom-com.
Now, that is...
J-Lo and Matthew McConaughey.
All right. Wedding Crashers? Where do we stand on Wedding Crashers? Again,
God, I haven't seen that
lots
so
of weddings.
Long.
Lots
Possibly
of weddings.
More weddings than that. Than four weddings and a funeral.
I think there's probably more weddings in Wedding Crashers, thanks to that montage, than in The Wedding Singer.
I think the only thing I remember about Wedding Crashers is the Funeral Crasher.
Oh, yeah, that was
Will
so
Ferrell,
bleak.
Right?
That's right. Yeah.
It's really dark.
That's the only thing I remember
about
that
film. Four weddings and a funeral crasher.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to suggest The Godfather.
Oh, yeah.
Like literally the first half hour of The Godfather revolves around a wedding.
His daughter's wedding.
His daughter's wedding. Luca Brasi. Shitting himself about a speech. Bonacera coming to the Godfather and asking for a favor. Michael saying, "That's my family, Kay. It's not me." Oh, Michael, if only you knew where you're going to end up at the end of the film. Looks like a fun wedding as well. And when I was rewatching The Godfather recently, I was kind of marveling at the job Coppola does marshalling that and making it feel like something that is actually happening. It's not, it doesn't feel overly staged and it doesn't feel overly cinematic in a way. It feels like we're almost eavesdropping on a real Italian American wedding, which is great.
Also, Italian food. Just so much food at the wedding.
Hey, also my big fat Greek wedding, speaking of food.
Yes.
Yeah. It's actually a really charming wedding movie.
It is. And can we talk about wedding movies without mentioning Father of the Bride?
Either.
Yeah. Only one has Martin Short, though, being brilliant.
Oh, yeah, as Franck.
Muriel's Wedding?
Yes. Although the wedding itself is very sad in that movie, actually. The wedding itself is a wedding of convenience, so that a South African swimmer can swim for Australia by marrying Muriel, basically. And she is very much not his choice, and it is a sort of loveless marriage. And she goes into it because she wants the big white wedding experience, and this is her way to have the big white wedding experience. And you know, she grows up a little bit as the film goes on. I don't know if we can call it our best wedding movie because of that cynicism in it.
How about here's an iconic ending to a movie, the ending of Wayne's World 2, where Wayne gay crashes the wedding of Tia Carrera, and then they elope.
On a bus. That's never been
done
before.
That's a great original ending to a movie.
Yeah, it's like such a bold and visionary way to just do something that you feel like you've never seen on the big screen before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We should point out, we are aware of The Graduate. In case people are yelling at us right now. Going, "You idiots!"
Banging on the windows.
Goddamn British Empire! Yes, The Graduate. The Graduate's an amazing ending. But I think if we're going to talk about any great wedding movies or any great weddings that take place in the movie, the conversation cannot be complete without mentioning Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer, in which Reed Richards and Susan Storm try to get married and it keeps being interrupted.
Yeah, that does have the best wedding crashers. Including Stan Lee, basically recreating his comic book attempt to crash their wedding and being thrown out on his ear.
And doesn't get interrupted by the Silver Surfer as well at one point.
So I think the Silver Surfer interrupts the first time, and then second time they're in Japan and there's something else coming up.
Something happens, then they get married at the end, don't they?
Do they? No, because that's the Japanese one.
Oh, that's the one that gets interrupted. Yeah. I would need to actually rewatch
Fantastic
Four Rise of the Silver Surfer to know that. So if you have, if Tim Story, you're listening to this and you do know the answer to this question, then do write in. But hey, Jamie Evans on Twitter, we wish you all the best for your wedding. And we hope that you play this segment of the podcast out loud at your wedding, maybe as your vows.
Yeah, please do not, Jamie, as our gift to you, play any of this at your wedding at all.
In fact, nobody play this bit.
That's probably best.
It's probably best. if you want to have your question read out on the Empire Podcast, you can get in touch via a number of methods. We're on Twitter as @EmpireMagazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast as Jamie Jevs did. And look what happened. We're also on Facebook as Empire Magazine, and we're on email as well, podcast@empireonline.com. Time now for this week's movie news. And there has been a fair bit of it, I would say.
Ooh, exciting.
This week has been filled with news of Rob Marshall's The Little Mermaid, which is the latest live-action adaptation of a Disney animated classic. They need to come up with a better name for these movies, because that's a real mouthful to say every single time. So it started with news that Melissa McCarthy had joined the film as Ursula, who is the main villain of the piece, of course.
The Sea Witch.
Sea Witch. Then we had news that Awkwafina and Jacob Tremblay have signed on to voice animated underwater creatures, because even though it's live action, there's still going to be a CG component when they go under the sea.
Under the sea. Yeah. And Jacob Tremblay is presumably Flounder, right?
He is Flounder.
He has to be.
He's got the little cheeks for it.
And Awkwafina is?
Sebastian?
Scuttle.
Scuttle the seagull.
Scuttle the seagull.
Cool.
So that's good. And then yesterday came news that Rob Marshall has found his Little Mermaid. He has found his Ariel. And she is Halle Bailey, who is one half of the Singing Sisters duo known as Chloe X Halle. Ben, you're into popular music. Mm-hmm. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Is it Times Halle? Is it Chloe X Halle? Do you know?
I honestly have no idea. This makes me feel old because I've never heard of Chloe X Halle, whatever they're called. But
yeah,
this seems like a really good choice. Having seen the news come out and gone, I actually don't know who this person is, went and did some looking, and her voice is absolutely incredible.
Her voice is extraordinary. And that is what you actually need for The Little Mermaid. I will also say that her smile is 100% like the cartoon. Like, I don't want to, you know, be shallow about this, but she looks exactly like Ariel's smile. It's genuinely weird. She's gorgeous. She can sing. I mean, I'm not sure what else you need. And I think also, like, having just seen Aladdin with leads who are beautiful, but at least one of them wasn't that great a singing voice.
What?
I'm saying it.
Who? Which one?
Aladdin.
No.
I mean, you know, he was fine, but he wasn't like the big Broadway voice that you maybe want for that role. And it's the same with this one. I think you need a great, great singer. I'm like, to the point where even Melissa McCarthy, I don't know her singing that well.
Oh, I'm sure she can sing.
Oh, I'm sure she can, but like Ursula, like, Poor Unfortunate Souls is an amazing song. She needs to nail that on the wall. And so it's really important that, you know, the Little Mermaid can sing. Ariel has to be able to sing.
Absolutely. This news has, of course, upset the racist dickheads.
Yeah. Well, which is nice.
I mean, of course it has. But I mean, everyone who is taking against this, like, it's brought out all the usual, like, what if we race flipped this character? And it's like, no, it's never been set in stone that this particular character has to be of any particular ethnicity.
I mean, she's a mermaid, dude.
She's a mermaid. And it's not like there is a cultural specificity to this story.
Obviously, a cartoon mermaid.
Cartoon mermaid. I mean, obviously, it comes from the Hans Christian Andersen sort of Danish tradition, but the story itself...
I did see one valid criticism which suggests that only Danish characters should play in this movie and that we should have Nicolas Coster-Waldau as Prince Eric and, wait for it, Mads Mikkelsen as Ariel. Now, that I would have some sympathy for that argument. Apart from that argument, I have no sympathy for this criticism, but please, carry on.
Yeah, it just feels like the whole point is that there is no sort of specific cultural background for this character. In fact, a lot of the songs have like that Caribbean feel. You think of something like Under the Sea. Mm-hmm. It just, it makes sense. And it means that more people are going to see themselves represented on the screen. Everyone who loves the original Little Mermaid is still going to be on board for this, but it's going to make it especially relevant and engaging for a whole group of people who rarely see themselves as this, like, princess character.
Absolutely. We should point out that, in case people haven't seen this news, that Halle Bailey is African-American, and so that is why the racist dickheads are upset and laughable idiots. Someone on Twitter said that whenever I was growing up, I'm a white girl, and I had red hair, and this was incredible for me, seeing Ariel on the big screen, because all the mean jokes suddenly fell flat, and people were suddenly admiring my hair, and it was amazing, and I felt great. I'm paraphrasing wildly here. And I want young black girls to have that same experience now with this Ariel as I did with my Ariel back in, when was it, 1992?
1989.
No.
Yep. It came out here in 1990, but it was...
Get out of town.
I will not.
Wow.
It was the very start of the Disney Renaissance. It was when they brought over Alan Menken and Howard Ashman. It's when they gave Musker and Clements their head to just, you know, bring back classic Disney, basically. It was the start of everything that followed. Without this, you don't get Beauty and the Beast, you don't get The Lion King, you don't get any of the good ones in the 90s. Pocahontas, any of them.
When you say that Disney gave Musker and Clements their head, was that Walt's Severed,
that's
Frozen
not
Head.
Walt Severed Frozen Head. Sorry, I mean Room to Work with.
Oh, okay.
Yes, yes. It's such an easy mistake.
The room that they're working in is the room where Walt Disney
is again
is frozen.
Not the cryogenic chamber.
Oh, okay.
No. Is it true that Frozen is actually about Walt Disney?
Again, no. It is not, no.
But yeah, fair play as well to Rob Marshall for going into this with an open mind and this exhaustive casting process. He actually has a quote here. There was a statement released yesterday. Halle possesses that rare combination of spirit, heart, youth, innocence and substance, plus a glorious singing voice, all intrinsic qualities necessary to play this iconic role, he said. And so fair play to him for feeling that he could think outside the box.
I mean, it gives this project a bit more of a reason to exist as well. Like, for me, the Disney live-action remakes that work best are the ones that
go
provide a
beast.
Slightly different spin. I really like Dumbo. I really like The Jungle Book.
Cinderella as well, far different from the original.
Yeah, whereas Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast, for me, it was just too much of a carbon copy. So, like, I'm all for a different take that also is inherently Disney princess live action.
And I guess now that we've seen Aquaman, we know that there is something to do with having live action underwater scenes that can work. You know?
I'm intrigued.
I was worried about
to see
that before.
How they do the underwater singing, because in Aquaman that never quite sat right for me. The sort of you can see that they are in water and around water, but they were just talking. Yeah. I don't know. It always felt a bit off to me.
Yeah,
I'm intrigued to see what they do here.
The way they addressed it in Aquaman was to not address it.
Yeah.
I mean, like many things in Aquaman, it worked best when you don't think about it.
Including is it the octopus playing drums or the squid playing drums? I can never remember what it is. And I apologize to cephalopods everywhere for getting that wrong. They'll be furiously writing in with their 6 or 8 tentacles.
8 or 10, isn't it?
Is it 8 or 10?
I've
got that wrong as well. Fuck's sake. Anyway, very, very exciting. But also, there is another search going on right now for an actor who can sing and who can act and who can look good as well. And that is Baz Luhrmann's search for an Elvis Presley, because his next film is an Elvis biopic of sorts, in which Tom Hanks has already signed on to play Colonel Tom Parker. Now, if you don't know Elvis necessarily, Colonel Tom Parker was Elvis's manager right from the beginning of his career all the way through pretty much until the end. And perhaps didn't always have Elvis's best interest at heart.
That's the way I'm going to say it.
So Tom Hanks is on board to play Colonel Tom Parker, and apparently the search for an Elvis has narrowed down to 5 people. Now I'm going to give you these 5 names. You tell me what you think, okay? Number 1 is Ansel Elgort.
Do you know what? He could kind of look the part.
He's kind of got that slightly cocky swagger to him.
Yeah, and there's something about the mouth that kind of works. I don't know. He hasn't quite happened yet. I feel like there have been films that promised to make him happen, and he hasn't quite happened.
Stop trying to make Ansel Elgort happen.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that going on. But at the same time, that's not to say that he won't get that film, because it has taken other stars much longer to kind of break through.
And of course, he's doing West Side Story right now for the Spielberg. So clearly, he can click his fingers in time. That's good. Stands him a good stead for Elvis, but clearly he's got something about him. Okay. Aaron Taylor Johnson. Now, I read one report that said it was down to 4 and Taylor Johnson's name was not on there. Mm-hmm. But I read another report that said there were 5 people still in the running and his name was on there.
Shouldn't having played John Lennon disqualify him?
No.
I mean, no disrespect, but you know.
Because you can do this thing where you can actually have a film about the meeting of the Beatles with the time when they met Elvis.
Whoa.
And you have Aaron Taylor Johnson playing Elvis and John Lennon.
Whoa. Blow my mind, dude.
Absolutely. I would be there for that all day
into
long.
Into the Beatles verse.
I don't know. How old is Aaron Taylor Johnson? Because he's been around forever. So
he started very young.
Late 20s, early 30s now,
okay.
Right?
See, I don't really know when this is focusing this biopic, but you'd imagine that it's probably Elvis's early days given the youth of the people involved. Aaron Taylor Johnson, I think, yes, and as he discussed on the Empire podcast with us, Helen, that he can play a bit of piano.
He can he's very musical guy.
He was very good in Nowhere Boy.
Oh yeah,
musical icon, but bringing a bit of humanity.
I'm going to say maybe the best actor on this list, but anyway, we'll get to it. There is one I don't really know. Number 3, Harry Styles.
I mean, you know, he would get bums on seats, and he can sing. He also has quite bouffant hair.
He does. He really does.
So, I mean, 3 strong strikes for him there.
I don't know. I see his career going in one direction. I don't really. I don't know. I don't know if he has the swagger to play the king of rock and roll. And hey, that's what makes him beautiful. But I'm running out really rapidly. Yeah. Number 4 on the list is
story of his life.
Number 4 on the list is the human Fitbit, Miles Teller.
I mean, he's the one that when you look at his face, you go, oh, you are very Elvis-y, actually.
Is he, though? and a nose, and there is something above his mouth.
He's not un-Elvis-y.
I think he's the most, like, surface level Elvis-y of the bunch.
Okay,
we know that he can keep beat without rushing or dragging, so that's
I mean, do we?
Because
he rushed and dragged a lot.
Yeah, but by the end, he was on it. That was just his tempo. Also, he kind of has that. He is a really good actor in The Right Thing. He's amazing in Whiplash. That film was so good. Mm. But he also has that slightly cocky, douchebaggy energy that if you're going to have that sort of rock and roll swagger, that I think he could bring that to it. But I don't know if he can sing. I've never heard him singing anything.
Apparently he can. Apparently all five people on the short list have proven their singing credentials elsewhere. He might bring his massive dick energy to it. Who knows?
Again, like Aaron Taylor Johnson, I feel like he's at the older end of the spectrum.
Yes.
So again, that might be a factor in terms of what story they want to tell. If it's early days Elvis and going into the army Elvis, he might be a little bit older for that.
Number five is the only real unknown on the list. He will be seen next week in The Dead Don't Die from Jim Jarmusch, and he's going to be in Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as well. But other than that, I don't know him. He is Austin Butler.
Yeah, so he's got a very small role in The Dead Don't Die, but he's not bad in it. He was quite good in The Carrie Diaries, which was the Sex and the City prequel series. Genuinely, not kidding. It's like the early days of Carrie. He's all right. He looks like an Elvis as well, and he's younger than the others maybe, so...
Yeah.
He's not a bad shite. He is quite Elvis-y looking, actually. He's got a lot of swagger in Dead Don't Die.
Okay. Here's where I am.
Okay.
Shut it down now. None of these five people. They're all great in their own way, but Elvis was Elvis, guys.
But do you know what? I was just thinking about this the other day, and I can't remember why, but I was just thinking about how Baz Luhrmann is actually underrated. Baz Luhrmann does crazy shit, and it somehow works. Baz Luhrmann convinces Netflix to spend like $100 million on this TV show about the birth of hip-hop.
Yeah,
he does stuff that shouldn't work and probably shouldn't be allowed and is completely crazy, and it's kind of amazing. And so his Elvis, I'm kind of here for in a way that I wouldn't be for most people's Elvis.
I'm here for it, yes, but I it's so weird because we've just had these conversations obviously about Bohemian Rhapsody and Rocket Man and how closely Taron Egerton resembled Elton John and how intentionally he didn't sound like Elton John, and I was totally fine with that and it was great. But Elvis is Elvis. And Elvis is one of the most charismatic. Go back and look at pictures of young Elvis.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, he's like Marlon Brando levels of charisma. It's incredible.
I don't know. I do think that there is an actor out there who can absolutely nail the swagger and the looks and everything and the confidence of young Elvis Presley. And that actor is Kurt Russell. And his time has passed, unless, of course, they're willing to go full Lola and de-age him like they did for Guardians 2.
That would also be acceptable.
I would be on board. If Baz Luhrmann announced tomorrow that Kurt Russell is playing Elvis, I would be absolutely 110%.
We've just decided to add $200 million to the budget.
Worth every penny. But no, listen, I think, I don't know, of the five, I wouldn't be surprised if Ansel Elgort ends up getting it. But the only thing that worries me about that would be his scheduling with West Side Story. Mm-hmm. But, you know, hey, that's not for us to work out.
Indeed.
Okay, so excited to see what Baz cooks up with that movie. There were a couple of trailers this week that caught my eye.
Mm-hmm.
Seemed to be a bit of a trailer week, actually. First trailer that caught my eye.
Is this going to be like, are you going to take this trailer apart? Is it Knives Out, Chris? Is that what you're saying?
It is indeed Knives Out, Helen, as you so correctly say, for Jumanji, the next level. Which is the first trailer that came this week. And I thought, I'm only kidding about the Knives Out thing, because I thought this looks terrific.
Yeah, it really does. I'm very, very here for Jumanji once again being back and being ridiculous. And The Rock this time being Danny DeVito inside, which is going to be, if anything, even more fun than last time, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a great sort of twist on the body swap formula thing, right? Because the thing that was great about the last Jumanji was A, nobody really had any expectations for it.
Yep.
B, it made a lot of use in the script of the rules of video games, but also had this sort of fun and silliness of a body swap comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of it, you go, well, I've seen that now. So if you're going to do that again, what's the twist on that going to be? And as soon as that moment came in the trailer, we all stood around Chris's computer watching it in the office, and we all started like howling when it was DeVito in The Rock and Danny Glover and Kevin Hart. It seems like Kevin Hart brings the biggest laughs in this trailer. He is really, really on it with this.
Okay, so in case people haven't seen the trailer, because I was worried about this. When they brought back the original kids from the first movie, when Jake Kasdan and co. brought back the original kids the last movie. There was another movie called Jumanji.
The previous movie.
The previous movie, Jumanji Welcome to the Jungle. I was like, oh, because I thought they could have gone in different directions with it. When they started casting Danny DeVito and Danny Glover, I thought, well, I hope that they would end up somehow in the avatars of... Can we remember their names? Smolder Bravestone.
Dr. Smolder Bravestone.
Dr. Smolder Bravestone.
Ruby Roundhouse.
Ruby Roundhouse.
Ruby Roundhouse.
Moose Finbar.
Oh, very good.
And
Dr. Shelley Oberon.
Very good.
If anyone can remember the name of Nick Jonas's character, you get an extra bonus point because I cannot remember. Anyway, I really, really liked the first film. If you go look up the review on EmpireOnline.com, you'll see I gave it 3 stars. It's one of my big regrets in my life. So let's bump that up. Let's give it a 4th star right here, right now. Really, really great family film. But I was worried that it was just going to retread the same ground. But I was hoping that it would be Danny Glover and Danny DeVito in the bodies of 2 of the avatars. And I thought it might be a whole bunch of old people in their bodies. Not quite that. So the story seems to be the Spencer, played by Alex Wolff this time, maybe has gone a little bit dark, possibly, or has been estranged from his friends after the ending of last movie, and is become a bit of a Jumanji junkie and has engineered a way back into the game.
I mean, he wants to be The Rock again. Who wouldn't?
Who wouldn't? Mm. Absolutely. Who wouldn't want to spend a weekend in The Rock?
Alcatraz is lovely this time of year, of course.
Welcome to The Rock. Then his friends go back in after him. They choose to go back in, but they haven't chosen their characters. And so when they end up in Jumanji, Martha, the Karen Gillan avatar character, Ruby Roundhouse, thinks that Spencer is once again in Dr. Smolder Bravestone. But he isn't. He's actually Danny DeVito, who is Spencer's uncle or grandfather.
Grandfather? I think grandfather, isn't he?
He says uncle at one point, doesn't he?
But
yeah, I think grandfather. And Danny Glover, who is one of his friends, is also in the body of Kevin Hart. And Kevin Hart, even more so, I think, than Jack Black in the first movie, seems to be committing to just basically doing a Danny Glover impression. Mm-hmm. And everything he said in the trailer made me laugh.
Yeah.
And that last bit where they do the smoldering face for Dr. Smolder Bravestone. And he's like, he's having a heart attack. His whole left side is shutting down every single time. Might piss myself laughing. Not literally, I have to make that clear. But
thank you so much
I did laugh a lot. I'm very excited.
The eagle sound effect when he turns on the smolder really kills me as well. Just perfect comic timing.
It's so great.
And it looks like more of the same, only more so.
Mm. Yeah,
hence the next level.
Hints of Awkwafina is in the cast.
Yes.
Presumably, she's in a big sort of snowy landscape, so presumably she's another avatar in the game. Because you've got the 2 older guys now also in the game, surely there needs to be more avatars to keep all the younger kids in.
Precisely, because we've got 2 who are displaced at the moment. Mm-hmm. So we have Spencer, we don't know where he is, and we have Bethany.
He could be Nick Jonas, who's back in it as well.
Mm. That's precisely. So we see Nick Jonas, and we see Awkwafina, and I'm guessing he's Nick Jonas, because I'm guessing that the first person to go into the game always becomes the Nick Jonas character. That makes sense. And then Awkwafina, these are all guesses. Mm. I'm guessing will be the Bethany character. But, you know, I'm excited about this. Again, add an extra star to the first movie. And I'm in a generous mood. Add an extra star as well. So that's 10 stars for Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. And very, very excited about Jumanji, The Next Level. I'm also very excited, guys, about Knives Out.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Chris Evans very much moving on from Captain America. I think it's fair to
say.
That's
the deleted scene from Endgame.
A fantastic cast. Like, even seeing it down on paper, you don't kind of get how good this cast is. And then you watch it and it's, you know, Daniel Craig turning up with Lakeith Stanfield to investigate, right? Mm-hmm. Sold already. And then it turns out that the entire family is made up of amazing actors.
And Daniel Craig, obviously playing a sort of southern gentleman by the name of Benoit Blanc.
Oh,
what a great character
name. That's a good
name.
Title name. So yes, the story is that Christopher Plummer is a rich patriarch. I mean, typecasting there after various other roles in the same genre, has been murdered. And some member of his family is suspected. One of his family, it seems. So they're all suspects.
Ooh. Jamie Lee Curtis is in this
as well. Jamie Lee Curtis looks great.
What a badass.
So this is the latest movie from Rian Johnson, and this feels like the... Although he would say that The Last Jedi was one for him as well, but this feels like the one for me after the one for them of The Last Jedi. And I had tremendous fun with this. Chris Evans' character, according to IMDb, is called Ransom Robinson. I don't know how true that is, but he appears to be some sort of dilettante, some sort of wastrel. Yeah, a grade A dickhead is. Yeah, he's got some MDE going on, definitely. So I think he does.
You're obsessed with MDE today. I'm slightly worried about that.
Well, I've introduced the concept. I want to usurp BDE.
Yeah. It's even bigger than
BDE. Yeah. Ana de Armas is in it as well. Michael Shannon, he almost certainly did it. Tony Collette.
No, that's Catherine too obvious. Langford. You can't have Michael Shannon do it. He has to turn out to be an angel at the end, you know?
That's true. Don Johnson. But then that's what they'd be expecting us to think, right?
Oh.
Yeah, the old double bluff. And it is Michael Shannon all along. Jaden Martell, it's a really, really great cast, and it looks like a really fun twist. It says the tagline is, a whodunit as no one's ever done it. So that's...
Ooh.
Fun, because it looks fairly straight down the middle. It looked very arch and comedic in the trailer, but it doesn't look like there's anything in here that's going to take us by surprise.
Rian Johnson doesn't do not surprising. So.
Precisely.
I like that they're selling it as a Rian Johnson whodunit, because obviously he's written and directed. This is his original project, and on the poster, it's kind of framed nicely over the magnifying glass.
Maybe this is finally the whodunit I've been waiting my entire life to see. Which is the one where the great detective who comes in to solve the case is actually the killer. Like, we all know Jessica Fletcher done it. I mean, come on. Nobody happens along to that many murder scenes. Like, she's got to be a mass serial killer. Maybe that is Daniel Craig's character in this.
Do you think?
Yeah, I think I've blown this thing wide open.
Okay.
Maybe it's Chris Evans. Like, maybe this is his absolute, you know, sort of anti-Captain America role.
I think Chris Evans, I don't know.
I think Chris Evans is going to die as well.
I think he's going to die. Do you think this is one of those things where it's a bit like something like A Death in the Nile or like just a general episode of Morse where the suspects start getting bumped off one by one?
Yes.
So you think that people like Chris Evans might not make it to the end?
I think he might not make it to the end.
There is a huge circle of knives that features prominently in the trailer. So if those aren't ending up in people's backs or kind of...
Almost certainly backs, I think, in this family.
Lots of backstabbing.
Mm. Yeah. I think I know who did it.
Are you going to say Michael Shannon?
Tim Curry.
Depends which ending you watch.
Anyway, that was exciting. Anything else, guys, that you were excited about?
Yes, Sandman.
Oh! Woo!
Yeah, there is extremely good news for Sandman fans. Which is fun to say this week, which is that Sandman is finally coming to screens, but it is coming, as it should, as a TV series on Netflix rather than squished into a film format, which would be disastrous for that story. Now, people who haven't read Sandman, it is almost impossible to sum up, but it's a Neil Gaiman comic from started in the very end of the 80s, I think, but went into the 90s. And it's about a character called Dream of the Endless. So he and his siblings are the sort of personification of ideas. So the eldest is Destiny, then Death, then Dream, then the twins, Desire and Despair, then Delirium, who was once Delight and then went mad, and then Destruction. So they are the seven endless, and they are, you know, giant beings, more powerful than gods. But as the story begins, Dream is locked up for 70 years. He's captured by a magician, locked away, and consequences follow from that. People go mad with sleeping sickness. There's kind of weird stuff going on all around the world. And also, he finally escapes. So he finally escapes, has to basically win back his kingdom and also face a sort of existential dilemma, I guess, in a weird way. But what's interesting about this and what makes it so hard to sum up and explain is the fact that Dream is essentially the god of stories as well. He's not God, but he's beyond gods, you know. He's the force behind stories. So the whole thing becomes a meditation on stories and on dreams and on what makes us human and on what dreaming is and what dreaming means. And it's stunning. It's absolutely stunning. Mm-hmm. And it's a story that Gaiman began with his end in mind. Now, there's lots and lots of tangents along the way. I have no idea how they're going to deal with those, even in a TV show. I feel like this is almost going to be an anthology show where Dream is a character in the background of some stories. And many of the stories in the books are not really about him.
There are cameos from DC characters as well.
Cameos, Batman, yeah. Constantine and Batman are in there. But it's
which
really.
Which you can't do here.
Yeah. Kim Newman is also in there, actually.
Kim Newman,
actual Kim Newman
wow.
of
Our
this
very
parish.
Own Kim Newman.
Is in the comic book of Sandman. That's I don't know if he'll be in the TV show. but it's a wonderful, wonderful, mind-bending, mind-blowing series that takes in mythology of numerous countries around the world and of cats. Like, genuinely, there's a bit that looks at the dreams of cats.
But not the musical cats.
Not the musical
not
cats,
okay.
thank
For a
God.
Second, I was like, I'm out.
You've lost me. No, I would never. It's incredible, and I am super hyped to see it. So this is David S. Goyer and Neil Gaiman himself are among the showrunners, along with is Alan...
Yeah, Alan Heinberg is
Heinberg,
the showrunner.
Yeah, is the showrunner.
Gaiman and...
Sorry, our executive producers.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully Gaiman being involved himself here is a good move, right? Because I just watched the Good Omens TV show, mm-hmm. which was really enjoyable, and he was extremely hands-on with that.
Yeah.
Whereas I really liked the first season of American Gods, but then when all the switcheroos with all the different showrunners started happening, I couldn't get back into it.
Yeah, I think this one is going to be less whimsical than Good Omens, because mm-hmm. a lot of that kind of tone and that whimsy came from the Terry Pratchett influence, I think.
Right.
This is a more serious affair in many ways, although there is a lot of comedy in it as well. But yeah, I hope that they take something from that success and take something from the areas where American Gods has fallen down, which is mm-hmm. that I think you need to commit to this. And that's going to be a tough ask, because is it going to be a very expensive show to make well? But they need to commit to getting to the end. I think that's really, really important. They can take as many sort of diversions along the way as they want, but they should commit to getting to the end. So I would almost film the sort of spine of the series first and then fit in as many tangents as you want along the way.
That's a tricky thing, isn't it? Because Preacher, for example, is coming to an end before
exactly.
it's really explored every tangent of the comic book. But yeah, I think they'll probably will commit to that over at Netflix. And also, while we're on the subject of TV shows and large streaming companies bankrolling them to a large extent, the Lord of the Rings TV show has been announced this week that J.A. Bayona is going to direct the first two episodes of the series and set the visual and tonal template for what comes next.
Yeah. I mean, while still being of the opinion that we don't need it and we should adapt something else instead that we haven't seen, I'll still totally watch it because, you know, Tolkien fangirl over here. So
yeah, I mean, Bayona's an amazing director. I really rate him. I think it'll just be fascinating as somebody who's only ever visualized Middle Earth through the lens of Peter Jackson to just see another filmmaker put their stamp on it. And I guess interesting as well that you had Peter Jackson coming from that horror background and kind of moving across to fantasy. And obviously Bayona has done fantasy stuff before in terms of like A Monster Calls, but he comes from that horror tradition with The Orphanage, and he has also brought that side of his filmmaking to the other projects that he's been involved in. So I'm fascinated to see what his Middle Earth looks like. And you want it to look a bit different, but also not too different from the Peter Jackson one.
But it's also going to film in New Zealand. That was announced this week that they did consider the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Someone actually said that Brexit was a major factor in the decision not to film over here. So well done, everybody. Mm-hmm. And but yeah, it's going to be filming in New Zealand. So therefore, it's going to have some of the feel. And I guess they'll actually want to continue that visual continuity, which is an inelegant sentence. But there you go. You can't have everything. A couple of last things before we wrap up and move on to this week's guest and then the movie review section. Paul Rudd.
Woo-hoo!
Has joined Ghostbusters 2020. That's not what the movie's going to be called, but that's just the shorthand for it right now. Did you see this announcement last week where you were in Glastonbury, weren't you?
I was at Glastonbury, you know.
So yeah, he filmed himself outside Hook and Ladder 8 in New York and then said, I'm joining Ghostbusters.
I mean, that's hard to argue with because he is like a little puppy and wants to go to space. So,
is he going to be related to Finn Wolfhard's character? Because they have a bit of a similar... I don't know.
Well,
I can imagine
eyes
Phil
and a nose, which is a symbol above a mouth.
I mean, they both have black hair. That's basically it. But
yeah.
I could see those two being related in some way. I don't know.
Sure.
Apparently, he's going to play a teacher. So I imagine maybe he is going to get involved with Carrie Coon at some point. And you know, but he seems like the right sort of fit. I think you know, he's got this sort of loose goose improvisational style.
He's super likable.
Yeah.
So he's also well versed in kind of action-y stuff as well, and bringing comedy to action. Yeah.
Excited about that. Also excited about Drew Pearce, who has got a movie coming out on Netflix. Well, it'll come out once he's filmed it and edited it and got it ready. But it's called Quartermaster, and he's going to be writing and directing, and Mark Platt will produce. And it's a high concept thriller. That's all we know about
it right
now.
That's all we have.
Yeah, that's all we have. But
so Quartermaster is the guy who parcels out supplies for the army, right?
That's correct.
So it's going to be a thriller about a guy with supplies. Like what some of his tallies don't add up. And he has to go on a quest.
Supplies.
He has to go on a quest to find the missing
supplies.
So
it's a high concept. Didn't say the concept was good, Helen. No, it'll be great. It'll be great.
It'll be good. It'll be good.
In Drew Pearce, we trust.
Yeah, we do.
And we should talk about the fact that the biggest movie of all time,
Avatar,
remains Avatar.
Mm. Mm.
Because last week's assault on the number one spot by Avengers Endgame, where they augmented the release, mm-hmm. shall we say, of Avengers Endgame. They put it into more cinemas across the world, and they added, I mean, wow.
Yeah.
Talk about packing a punch.
Whew.
Did you go, Helen?
I did.
I went, yeah.
So basically, there was a very, very short introduction from one Russo brother because they apparently couldn't get both, which seems like, you know, it's kind
I've met them both. You've met them both. They come as a pair,
they
right?
They do come as a pair. So it's weird that they literally, I mean, pretty literally half-assed it, let's be honest. And then at the very end, you get a lovely, genuinely lovely tribute to Stan Lee with footage, sort of behind-the-scenes footage of practically all his cameos. And it's genuinely moving and delightful. But it's short, but genuinely delightful. Then they have a deleted scene. It's a post-viz scene, so it's kind of unfinished effects. It's deliberately kind of blocky, quick-to-render effects. I don't know if we can talk about that as a spoiler. We can maybe talk about it more when we do the Spider-Man spoiler podcast. What do you think?
I guess we can, but let's just say
it's Hulk-focused.
I was going to say it's the alternate introduction of a character in the film, but I wasn't going to say who it was. But yeah, it's a Hulk. And it's a fun scene.
It's a very fun scene.
It features Reginald Fell Johnson from Die Hard.
I know.
Playing a very Die Hardy role.
That was very fun.
That was fun. I can see why they cut it. It wasn't finished for one
thing. Yeah, it wasn't necessary. But yeah, I can understand why they cut it. And then they basically go into the first minute and a half, 2 minutes of Spider-Man Far From Home.
I'd say 45 seconds, but yeah.
Okay. It's not a lot. And I genuinely feel like what would have got fans excited and what genuinely might have helped them overtake Avatar is if they, I'm talking literally in a room, had Bucky and Sam hanging out for 2 minutes or had Peter talking to Morgan for 2 minutes. Genuinely, I feel like that would have been enough for people to get excited and go to this film, but they couldn't even quite manage that.
Oh, shame on them.
Shame.
Shame.
Chris and I were talking about this earlier in the week, that it, to me, it felt a bit slightly mistimed, that obviously we'll get into this, but Spider-Man Far From Home is set post-Endgame and it kind of deals with the aftermath of Endgame, but it really doesn't feel at all like Endgame has left. And I think that actually there might be a little bit of another push to see Endgame again after having people have had a chance to see Far From Home, had a little bit more distance, and then you do it as a full-on re-release of like, oh, it's kind of been and gone and you've seen Spider-Man now, but like, come on, Endgame was amazing and you want to see all the stuff that leads into Spider-Man.
I'd love to see it. Come on, it was amazing.
Come on!
Come on!
You will! You will, you will, you will, you will.
Go on.
The
Mrs.
Doyle
cuss.
That'd be amazing.
That'd be incredible.
Just wearing Thanos down.
Maybe they feel like they're not quite far enough down the line with these Disney Plus shows, but if you had a couple of little deleted scenes, I mean, look, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 had what, 5 scenes during the end credits?
Mm-hmm.
If they had done that with this, they would have been past Avatar.
Okay, so
it would have been more expensive, but they would have been past Avatar.
Still a fun experience going back and watching it again.
Yeah.
That was fun. I have slight quibbles with the package, so to speak. But what is interesting is that it still isn't there in terms of the box office. It's 27 million. This was on Monday, so it might have inched ever closer.
Sure.
Say 20, let's call it $26.5 million behind Avatar, which is 2.788 billion, I think, at the moment. So it's really, really, really close. Mm. And there were some box office prognosticators, all of whom, including, you know, me, if I can call myself that, have been proven wrong by this, because whenever it opened to 1.2 billion, I was like, oh, it's going to be the first $3 billion movie. It's going to blow past Avatar. I never thought this would happen. Oh, amazing days. But we're dealing with something truly unprecedented here, because where do you go from a $1.2 billion opening?
Exactly.
The only way to go is down, and it has slowed down really, really quickly.
It's still been 10 weeks in cinemas, which is not bad by any means.
Fantastic. And it's done $2.7 billion. And
again,
that's
not bad.
What's interesting is this $27 billion behind Avatar. I didn't know this until this week, that Avatar's total actually contains
$33
million from its re-release. Mm. So therefore, if I just enter some numbers into the computer here, carry the three. Hold the two. There's a... Hold that. Boobies. That's weird. Avengers Endgame's winner by $6 million.
But Avengers Endgame also includes a... I guess it's not technically a re-release. It's not technically a re-release.
Yeah, not technically a re-release. So, there you go.
Okay, fine.
Always bet on Thanos. That's what I say.
So is that what you say?
How many times
have you seen Endgame and you're still betting on Thanos? Do you need to go and see it again?
It's like the goes wrong. I keep going back, hoping that this time is the time to get it right. And maybe this time is the time that Thanos realizes that everything he needed was right there. The love of his two daughters. And he didn't need to do all this gauntlety stuff. He just needed to settle down in that cottage, making them stew. And just, you know, having Nebula and Gamora just be awesome and independent people. Come on, Thanos.
Hey, we should probably do some reviews at some point. Or have a guest or something.
Let's do both of those things.
Hey, cool.
Let's have a guest, and then we'll talk about reviews. So this week's guest is, and not for the first time on the podcast, I believe. In fact, I know, because he was one of our guests on the live show, the very first live show I think we did. Was it episode 100? So there you go. He's back again. Hooray! Yay. Will Poulter. We love Will Poulter here. And this week he returns as one of the stars of Ari Aster's Midsommar.
Midsommar.
So, am I pronouncing that correctly?
It's open to interpretation. Okay.
Midsommar, which is incredibly, we won't spoil the review. I haven't seen it, but I hear it's an incredibly brilliant, very gory, very shocking horror movie set in Sweden. And Will Poulter is one of the characters who goes to Sweden to take part in a festival and bad things happen. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. Yes. I don't think I knew that as a spoiler.
Okay, so there you go. So here is Will Poulter talking to Ben Trapp. Ben?
Yeah, it was me.
In this very booth today. What did you talk about?
We talked about his reaction to, I don't know, getting on board with the film. He went to Glasto. We talked a bit about his trip to Glastonbury. Apparently, nobody was brutally murdered, so that's good.
Yep.
I see that as an absolute win.
Mm. Yeah.
He also went to Wimbledon this week.
I turned on Wimbledon, and
there he was in the stands. And, like, Midsommar had conditioned me to be worried when I saw Will Poulter and grass together, so it was scary.
Fantastic. Here we go. Will Poulter talking to Ben Travis. Do please enjoy.
Welcome to the Empire Podcast. Will Poulter, how are you doing?
Thank you. I'm really good. Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Good, good. Yeah, thanks for coming in. So you're here to talk about Midsommar. Yeah. And I watched the film last night, stumbled out of the cinema about midnight, and I still don't feel okay. That is a lot to deal with. It's a heck of a film. I understand your reaction was kind of similar, of just being sort of knocked out and grossed out and overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, I knew exactly what you were talking about when you said that, because I had a very similar reaction. And it's kind of strange, like, I really don't enjoy watching myself. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been lucky, I've worked with so many great people that, like, I enjoy watching the films that I'm in, everything but for the stuff that I'm in. But what I've found is, you know, when you feature in something, it's kind of hard to sort of detach yourself from the memories of shooting it. And I think seeing the kind of the seams and the stitches and with Midsommar, and I think like the kind of like best films, you know, I was able to like just totally disassociate myself from the kind of making of the of the film and the process behind it, and just, I don't want to say enjoy it, but be kind of honestly affected by it in such a powerful way. And I think, you know, I kind of speak for the whole cast when I say that we all were just completely overwhelmed by it and all felt sort of wowed and disturbed kind of in equal measure. And normally it's sort of like a cast and crew screening. There's a lot of kind of hugs and high fives and congratulations and all that kind of stuff immediately afterwards. But we all sat in silence for quite a long time afterwards and just allowed the sort of effects of the film to kind of wash over us. And it has a lingering effect that, stayed with me for at least a couple of days. I had the worst night's sleep of my life.
Oh, really?
The night before.
Like lack of sleep?
Sorry, night afterwards.
Lack of sleep or like horrible dreams or...
Terrible, terrible dreams. Like full-on nightmares. Mm. Which is strange because I wouldn't actually describe the film as being typically scary or even as scary as, say, Ari's first film, Hereditary, or some of the other kind of films it might be sort of compared to or has been compared to. But it is utterly disturbing. Mm. And it's that kind of disturbing feeling that sort of lingers, I think, longer than a fright. Like, a fright has a very limited sort of, lifespan. This idea that, like, humans are capable of what you see in Midsommar is kind of what's most disturbing about it.
It really feels as well like it deals in the that like classic idea of the uncanny. Everything you're seeing is kind of like sort of normal, but just cranked up that little bit higher that it feels uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Even before you get into the like really extreme stuff, which the film absolutely goes to those places.
Right. Yeah, and that's really interesting. And I think there you've hit on what is so kind of special about Ari as a filmmaker, is I think he takes things that are very, on the surface, normal, even intriguing and kind of pleasing on the eye at first. So, you know, you have this community of smiling, friendly, open, compassionate people, but then he sort of like messes with the dials and, you know, turns things here and there, and suddenly, you know, it's all flipped on its head. With Hereditary, he took a theme like grief, you know, something that, of course, isn't pleasant by any means by its very nature, but is totally relatable, you know, is very accessible for audiences. You know, a lot of people have experienced and will experience the process of grief and losing someone. And that's your access point before he turns up the dial and turns that grief into something that's truly horrifying. With Midsommar, I'd say he does that again. The theme of grief is kind of present, but then also he takes something as relatable as relationship stress and being trapped in a relationship that is like toxic for both you and the other person. And he just turns up the dials to the point that it's like distorting and horrifying.
And those are the characters played by Florence Pugh and Jack Rayner. In fact, you were talking about watching the film. There was an amazing tweet the other week from Florence Pugh, having just seen it, where it was just a kind of, I'm staring at the floor, I can't. Like, did you all see it in that same screening together? Did you watch it with her and with the rest of the cast?
Funnily enough, so Florence is a prolific and talented tweeter. She's always like amused me very much on Twitter. But we watched it separately initially. I think Florence watched it on her own first, which is totally understandable because she's in practically every frame of the movie. And by the way, the performance is out of this world good. And then we watched it all together in New York, which was initially really lovely. It was catching up. I was like, hey, everybody. There was like a lot of laughs in the first third to sort of half of the movie. Which
it's like a surprisingly funny film as well, right?
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, surprisingly funny. And then it's suddenly not funny at all, and it's very disturbing. So it's quite a nice sort of shift in tone and mood. Mm. And I was slightly caught off guard by it, despite reading the script and despite being in it and shooting it and sort of presumably knowing what, you know, to expect. Mm. I was still caught massively off guard.
I mean, with the script, how much of a sense of the film did you get from that? Because obviously there is all the plot stuff and the character stuff, which I'm sure you get from the script, but the visuals in this are incredible. The production design, the fact that it is, you see that it's very clearly you're shooting in a field with these huts and everything looks gorgeous and weird. Did you get a sense of that visual style of the film and how special it was going to be in that sense from the script, or did that come later?
Yeah, that's a really good question, particularly with this film, because I think it was very ambitious on the page. It was like very visceral to read, and that was exciting, and of course that's encouraging, and you think, wow, this is daring, and this is, you know, really kind of trying to sort of push the envelope in lots of respects, both narratively and visually. But can anyone actually pull it off? I mean, it's great on paper, but what is it going to be like in practice? And I think watching Ari's short films, taking into account just how brilliant Hereditary was, and then getting the chance to talk to him, and he's just an avid cinephile who's watched everything, and also as a writer-director, such an intimate understanding of everything that's on the page, particularly his characters, I quickly realized, oh, this is the guy who's going to pull it off. Mm-hmm. Like, this ambitious script has a, you know, good chance of being executed really, really well. And if so, we have a kind of winning movie. And I think I feel immensely proud to be a part of it, you know, I think for the reason that it is so daring. And it's kind of like this sort of strange, psychedelic kind of like fireworks display in the daytime. Mm-hmm. And Ari pulled it off.
So your character is Mark. He's one of the American tourists who gets invited into this strange Swedish festival that is a little bit more sinister than it first seems. Mm. How did you feel about Mark as a character on the page? Because he's the member of the group who he's very skeptical and he's kind of obnoxious. He's kind of comedic, but he's a bit of a dick.
He's definitely a dick. Yeah, 100%. So Mark was an interesting character to me because I feel like I'm intrigued by characters who kind of possess a sort of duality. Mm. You know, someone who projects one thing and internally is something very different. So I think Mark, you know, comes with a lot of bravado and projects a lot of confidence, but internally he's very insecure and self-loathing. And that's not me being an apologist for his problematic behavior, because he's clearly a very regressive, out-of-touch male. And, you know, it was interesting to me getting the opportunity to kind of play someone who I think is an example of kind of how not to be in lots of respects. And so I guess I was encouraged by the idea that while on occasion you might be laughing with Mark, ultimately you're laughing at him and kind of what a dick he is. And he sort of stands out as a kind of sore thumb, particularly in this day and age where I think, albeit late, but we are kind of turning our attention to sort of addressing some of the problematic behaviors and attitudes within the male community. It's like Mark is the poster child for kind of what we can't afford to sort of suffer any longer. And yeah, the easiest way to describe him is a dick.
Yeah, there's definitely a few toxic men in
this
film.
Well, there's a couple, exactly. Yeah, very true.
So it is an amazing cast for this. So obviously, we've spoken about Florence Pugh. He's just amazing. And you've worked with Jack Rayner quite a few times before. Yeah. And you've got William Jackson Harper. Like, did you guys get to have fun? Obviously, it's a hugely intense film, but it's also you guys off in a field doing make-believe. And, like, did you get time to, like, hang out and have fun? Or was it very intense, all down to work?
No, definitely. And I think, you know what, sometimes in my experience, I can only kind of speak for me personally, but in my experience, sometimes the kind of pre-production stage is like rarely there at all for actors. Sometimes, you know, you're lucky enough to get a role and then you find yourself kind of flung pretty much straight into the shooting process. And that's something that I think can actually ultimately end up hurting the film, and certainly makes the process a lot harder. Whereas on the shoot for Midsommar, we were kind of blessed to have several weeks as a cast, kind of getting to know each other, gelling, spending a lot of kind of table time, unpacking the script, talking in depth about our characters and their kind of various dynamics. And that was so, so helpful. And it was no mistake either. It was kind of, you know, Ari's design. He engineered it to be that way. And I loved that. You know, it was something that I really missed and craved on other films that I've done, where maybe for whatever reason, you know, we haven't had that opportunity. And it helped massively that I'd already built a kind of foundation of friendship with Jack Rayner. We've done three films together and a fourth recently, the short film that he directed. Yeah. So, and Florence, I knew. William Jackson Harper, I didn't. But, you know, I feel like in him and Archie Madekwe and Wilhelm, you know, I've made hopefully friends for life. That such a great group. And, you know, while there were like difficult themes, obviously, and it was in many places a dark film, there was more than enough, you know, space for fun and levity as well.
Yeah, what did you guys do to sort of bond together?
We did some interesting exercises. One of them was that we went to a restaurant where you kind of cook your own food. That's the sort of, you know, gimmick of the restaurant. But we went in character with Ari kind of giving us some kind of soft direction before going into the restaurant. But we were in the restaurant for sort of a good kind of 2 hours or so in character. And that was a really interesting exercise. And
especially for your character, where you happen to be kind of horrible or just kind of flippant and kind of rude.
Yeah, it was weird. It was like, it was kind of fun because it came, I think, at the end of a kind of week or two of sort of unpacking the script and reading it and you know, spending time with one another. So it was an opportunity to kind of put certain things into practice. But also I'm wary of just how kind of obnoxious and loud Mark is. And so, you know, I was doing my best to kind of serve the exercise, but I was also trying not to like ruin the date that was happening next to me. There was a couple on a date, and I'm pretty sure that I will have said some pretty offensive things right in their earshot while they were sort of, you know, making each other pancakes and flambéed strawberries. So that was like a little bit awkward, but it was a really fun exercise, different to anything I'd done before, and a really kind of useful improvisation. Certainly something that bonded us.
Did the restaurant know that you were doing that? Did they know that was happening?
No, the restaurant didn't. No. All I can remember is Wilhelm's character, Pele, who's played by Wilhelm, just apologizing for me a lot, which I thanked him afterwards because I was like, I couldn't really apologize as much as I would have liked to because I was sort of like trying to serve the exercise. But yeah, it was a funny thing to experience.
And what did you cook? It was cook your own food.
Well, I feel like I just ate the food prematurely at every opportunity while he was kind of actually doing the cooking, and I was just sort of, you know, that annoying friend who kind of like snacks at food before you're actually sort of like finished making it. I was just kind of that, I think. Yeah, and I can't remember, it was some kind of ramen, I think.
Ooh.
Far outside of Mark's comfort zone, and definitely out of mine as well. I'm not skilled enough to be able to produce that, but Wilhelm did it, so
amazing.
So are you a festival guy? This is a sort of a really kind of fucked up festival film.
Yeah.
Are you a festival person? It was Glasto at the weekend.
Yes.
Did you go?
I went to Glasto.
Did you? How was it?
I did. It was great. It was great. I think, though, at 26 years old, I'm kind of like feeling like I should have more stamina than this, but I can't really do the like 3-4 day kind of crazy festival experience anymore. Like I need to be in bed kind of before most people are still up, and but it was really fun, and it's great to see kind of such a great array of music. And
yeah, who did you see?
I saw Dave, I saw Slow Tie, I saw Jungle, I caught a bit of Sean Paul as well, Kylie.
Oh, that Kylie set was huge.
Amazing. Janet Jackson too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I caught a lot of music, and Stormzy obviously made a kind of, well, gave a historical performance there, so that was amazing incredible. To see. Yeah,
amazing, and nothing bad happened. No horrible midsummer experiences. What's the worst thing that's happened to you in a field?
I was gonna say the worst thing that's happened to me, probably putting on, you know, like welly boots after they filled up with rainwater because you left them outside your tent. That kind of thing. But no, nothing quite on midsummer's scale. But actually, this time around, the weather was amazing.
So. It was almost a midsummer experience, right? Because it was like insanely hot, probably really uncomfortably hot and bright.
That's it. Uncomfortably hot. Bright, but no horrifying things happened, luckily.
How did you feel when you were shooting the film, when you went onto that set? Because we mentioned it before, that it is, you can really clearly see in the shots that it is this huge field, and they've built all these kind of crazy huts and stuff. How did you feel walking into that for the first time? Was that held off until you shot those scenes entering the camp, or had you already been in there?
Pretty much, by and large. I think, you know, we saw it kind of maybe for the first time on the day before, or maybe the day of shooting the first scenes that took place in the village. And actually, I meant to mention it, that Henrik Svensson, who's the kind of head of the art department, did such an amazing job, and his team created something that was so kind of immersive and realistic for us, and really did, I think, help us kind of convincingly play, you know, this idea that we were kind of, you know, really taken back and genuinely experienced kind of wonderment the first time we go there. And it was just amazing to see all the detail and the kind of extreme amount of effort that had gone into constructing these sets. And the film kind of, if you can stomach it, warrants kind of multiple watches, because there are all these kind of clues hidden in the sort of design. So a lot of the kind of paintings on the walls, or a lot of the kind of just imagery, has sort of hidden meanings, various kind of symbolism going on, foreshadowing and whatnot, clues about how the story unfurls. And that's also something that Ari really likes to embrace. He did it in Hereditary.
Yeah.
He's kind of really, again, turned up the dials on that this time around with Midsommar.
So I guess a lot of people will have seen you last in Bandersnatch, the Black Mirror sort of choose your own adventure film, which was what a cool experience. Like even just watching it and playing it, however you define that. Did that come before Midsommar? When did those jobs come about?
Yeah, that's a good question. So that came about just before I shot Midsommar. I kind of went on to Midsommar, I guess, a short while after wrapping on Bandersnatch. And I feel so lucky to have been part of that project. Again, really daring and ambitious kind of project. But, you know, you look at the people involved, and, you know, Annabelle Jones and Charlie Brooker and David Slade, the director, you know, you quickly see, okay, well, this is, yes, very ambitious, but, you know, you've got some incredibly talented, very kind of experienced, you know, people behind it. So it was just a real pleasure to be involved and to work with Asim, who, you know, is a friend now, but someone I've loved from People Just Do Nothing.
Yeah.
Finn gives an unbelievable performance, and Craig Parkinson's great. There's just so many, you know, brilliant elements to that. And I really loved it. Very, very challenging. It was.
Yeah, what about the challenge of shooting something in that way? Because, I mean, we're not used to experiencing stories in that way, let alone for you as an actor being part of shooting those multiple branching storylines. And did you have a sense of where the story was going, or did you just have to try and do your part in each? scene? Or
I didn't actually know exactly, yeah, because I didn't actually know how to approach it. Having never done it before, I was like, do I approach this in the normal way? Because I struggle enough as it is managing a character arc when you're shooting, you know, out of continuity. Mm-hmm. I find it difficult sort of managing the kind of emotional journey of a character when there's a singular kind of narrative strand. So when there's multiple narrative strands and you're also having to account for sort of different choices and different histories, you know, for your character, and then also different futures, you don't want any decision you make in the moment to kind of cause a sort of kink in the mm-hmm. arc that you're trying to create. So it was really tough. And you know, I mean, there were times when I'd deliver dialogue to the person opposite me and they'd be looking at me and like, with a look in their eyes like, that's the wrong
like,
version.
Oh, or, this isn't this storyline.
Yeah, that line is in the other option. Uh-huh. You need to, like, you know. So that was a unique challenge. Mm. And, you know, some of the other actors were like unflappable, whereas I really struggled with that. But yeah, really fun. And I'm so glad that I, you know, got an opportunity to do, I guess, kind of one of the earliest sort of efforts in that respect.
And did you play it when it came out? Did you watch it? Or I mean, I guess it's hard when you're in it, but yeah, there's so much that's outside of your character as well. Were you more tempted than usual in terms of watching a film that you're in?
Yes, yeah, I guess I was. I also kind of knew pretty well how I would be able to best enjoy it because as soon as I sort of got rid of myself, I was able to kind of just sort of sit back and relax.
Yeah, did you chuck yourself off the balcony?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I've sat next to loved ones and family members who've thrown me over the balcony while I'm just sat, you know, right next to them. But it is genuinely one of those things you can kind of go back and sort of, you know, try multiple times mm-hmm. and have multiple experiences with, which is really cool and obviously, you know, very unique. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, there were obviously kind of horror elements to that. Oh. Also last year, I really loved The Little Stranger. That film was really stayed with me, and I thought you were absolutely great in it.
That's really kind.
And that was obviously not an all-out horror, but it had this kind of under-bubbling sort of gothic feel to it.
Yeah.
And then Midsommar, are you a horror guy? Is that a genre that appeals to you as a viewer as well as an actor?
It's funny, I guess I've never really gravitated towards one genre more than the other. Mm. I think, you know, kind of forced to say whether I prefer sort of comedy or drama, I think I would say drama and the various genres that you kind of fall under that umbrella. But I find myself, you know, in a sort of horror that is also kind of in part a comedy as well, playing quite mm-hmm. a kind of comedic character. And that, I guess, probably goes slightly against my interest as a viewer. But Midsommar is, you know, and I don't know what it says about me, but it's very much my cup of tea still. Yeah. And I do like films that kind of exist in the grey areas. You know, I was so lucky to work with Lenny Abramson, who's one of my favourite directors, on that project, The Little Stranger. And yeah, I like the fact that it wasn't easily definable. It wasn't, you know, a sort of out-and-out horror. It was also a period drama. It was also a kind of psychological mm-hmm. thriller. It was also something that you couldn't quite put your finger on, that there maybe mm-hmm. isn't a label for. And I really loved the complexity of that character. Again, sort of, you know, felt as though he had a kind of duality to him as well. And it was a joy to be a part of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for a while as well, kind of early on in production, you were attached to it for the Pennywise role. Was that from a desire to kind of, I don't know, to, it's one thing to be in a horror film and lots of stuff happens to you in Midsommar, but to be a sort of horror villain, a horror icon, is that something that appeals to you, or was that something that, having had that experience, you're like, I'm kind of done with that?
I don't know. I mean, I was really glad to see, you know, that it went ahead and you know, had so much success. I think Bill Skarsgård did a fantastic job, and very pleased for Andy as well, the director, who's such a lovely guy. So that's kind of wonderful. I think for me, so long as I feel like I can, you know, authentically embody the character and do my best, that's kind of what governs my decisions when it comes to taking a role in the context of a story that I feel like I can subscribe to and kind of get behind the message of. But whether it's a villain or a hero, you know, for want of a less kind of reductive, you know, way of putting it, I don't mind. It's just whether I can kind of authentically play that person. But no, I would still be open to playing, you know, villains. I'm kind of open to playing anything, provided it's kind of appropriate, you know.
And you mentioned it before, you've been working with Jack Rayner on his short film debut.
Yeah.
Right, I'm sure I'm going to pronounce this wrong because it's Irish film, right?
Yes. Bonya. Yeah, exactly.
What can you tell me about that? Because you're the lead in that, right?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because Jack is someone who, you know, is not only a very close friend of mine, but someone I'm a fan of, you know, from his work as an actor. And, you know, when someone as talented as Jack in, you know, one domain says, oh, I'm going to cross over into this other one and start directing. Honestly, I was nervous. I was like, I don't know. I don't want you to fall between stools. Like, you're so great as an actor. Like, don't hang up the acting boots and then, you know, go fully over into directing because you'll be missed. And I was worried and maybe, honestly, a little bit skeptical. And he knows that. And honestly, like, to watch your friend take to something as kind of, not like even seamlessly, just brilliantly as he did, and fulfill the role of a director as kind of confidently and successfully as he did with Bonya, like, it's amazing. I'm going to Galway relatively soon for the festival out there where we're going to be premiering the film, and immensely proud to be a part of it. It's inspired by Irish history, set during the time of the Great Famine, and it's also stylistically inspired by a lot of Japanese ghost stories that Jack is kind of very well versed in, and Jack captures all of that in this really kind of beautiful little black and white short that called Bonya, which means milk in Gaelga.
Ooh, yeah. Okay. Fun fact for
there you.
There
you go, yeah.
So what else has this summer got in store for you?
I'm with the Midsummer Tribe on the promotional trail for a little bit longer, but it is out Friday, July 5th. And other than that, really annoyingly, and I know this is annoying, I'm not allowed to say, but I'm looking forward to what's next and getting back to work and getting my hands dirty.
No holidays in Sweden, right?
Sweden is such a lovely place. Don't let Midsummer put you off Sweden. Yeah. It's the best place that I've been recently. It's so, so lovely.
So you've been to Sweden. Did you have to apologise?
I need to go back and apologise, but I went for Midsummer a few months before we started shooting, and it was phenomenal, and not like the Midsummer you see in the film. I mean, inspired by only.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, thanks so much for coming along.
Thank you.
Thanks, Will Poulter.
Cheers. Thanks a lot, man.
Okay, so that was Will Poulter. And now let's get on to the movie review section. And when you've just spoken to Will Poulter, the star of Midsommar, there is only one place, only one film with which you can begin. It is, of course, you know where I'm going with this, Helen.
Yeah.
Spider-Man Far From
Home.
Now, we did talk about this briefly last week, but that was with two completely different people.
Oh, well, that doesn't count.
Two completely different people. And one of them doesn't even like Marvel movies. I don't even know how he got in here, quite frankly. Ian Freer.
Oh.
I mean, he liked the film, so I let him live. But
that's fair.
Otherwise, James Starr was the other one, and his opinion, I think, doesn't really count. I think we've established that. So, Helen.
Hi.
You like the Marvel movies?
I have been known to like a Marvel movie or two, yes.
Ben?
Yeah, they're all right.
Okay, good.
They're very good.
You may talk about this movie.
Yes. Thank you. In this film, set 8 months after the events of Endgame, everyone's back at school, everyone's living their lives again after what they're now calling the blip, where half the population of the world disappeared for 5 years. And they're just trying to get back in the swing of it, including Spider-Man, who's obviously been dealing with the consequences of that, shall we say. I don't want to spoil anything for the three of you who still haven't seen it. Anyway, so he's going on his class trip to Europe, and he just wants to have a nice trip to Europe. But wouldn't you know it, Nick Fury needs his help with something and tries to recruit him and basically hijack his trip to help out Quentin Beck, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, who basically introduces himself to Spidey, explains that he's come from another dimension, another Earth, and that he's trying to save our Earth from what happened to his Earth.
Earth 616.
That's right.
I like that touch.
It was really good.
Very good.
So that's basically your setup for the film, with lots of globetrotting, with Peter also trying to find time to sort of confess his feelings for MJ, played obviously by Zendaya, and just a whole amount of incredibly cute, likable teenage behavior.
So likable.
They're so likable.
So likable. Ben, what did you think of this movie?
I really enjoyed it.
Thanks,
I didn't.
Ben. The next movie is. Yes, carry on.
No, I really liked it. I didn't like it quite as much as Homecoming, but for me, Homecoming is top five MCU. I love it so much. It's like. Yeah, it's top five MCU for me, and we might be getting into this at some point.
Okay.
Yeah, I absolutely love Spider-Man Homecoming. The thing that I love about Spider-Man Homecoming is that, for me, it's kind of miraculous that in a world that has seen so many Spider-Men, too many Spider-Men, as Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt might say, that you get Tom Holland comes along and he is immediately like the most Spider-Man you could possibly imagine, and yet also completely different to these previous incarnations. And it felt, so incredibly Spider-Man-y and yet really different to the Amazing Spider-Man and the Raimi Spider-Man incarnations. So I loved that about it. I love teen movies. That's just a world that I love being in. For me as well, it was just like the funniest film of that year. It wasn't even ostensibly a comedy.
Yeah, it was a great movie.
And Homecoming completely cracks me up.
It's very, very funny.
To say that this isn't quite as good is just to kind of... It's still very good. It's like proper mid-tier Marvel. It's still really funny. All the stuff between the kids is still great. And I love the fact that there's a lot going on in this film. You've got Peter Parker on his class trip. You've got Mysterio and the Elementals and all these different threads going on.
Such a great band name, by the way.
the Elementals, by the way, are the threat that Spider-Man and Mysterio have to face.
The big kind of monstery, one's kind of fiery, one's kind of
rocky. They're the elements,
Hydro-Man and Molten Man are the names of these characters, and they're awful villains in the comic book. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what John Watts, who's returning to direct here, was intrigued by. Can I make these terrible, terrible all CG characters, kind of give them personality and kind of make them actually decent threats for Peter Parker?
And I feel like he partially succeeds in that. I really like that they're enemies that Spider-Man is like the least suited
incredibly badly suited to fight
them, because like none of his usual tricks work on them. And it plays really nicely with taking Spider-Man and putting him in situations and literally in places, because they're in Europe, that he's never been to before, having to contend with these obstacles in a different way. And despite all of that going on, it never loses sight of Peter Parker wanting to ask out MJ. Yeah. And I loved how strong that thread was all the way through.
Yeah, I think it's great. I obviously really, really liked it. I think it does some really, really clever things. I think it's Marvel's most small P political film. I don't think Marvel does capital P political, but this actually has some really, really interesting things to say in the second half, which I won't get into because it would be a spoiler, but we will in the spoiler special, that it's quite pointed, actually. And I feel like the people who have thought that Marvel kind of sat on the fence on certain issues, it doesn't actually sit on the fence.
We've had this conversation before, and I think you're on the same page as me. I don't think they've ever sat on the fence.
I don't think they have either, but people...
Where they sit as a company.
People argue the other side to me, and I don't think they can on this one, is what I'm saying.
Agreed. But I also, you and I have talked a lot to the people who write and direct these movies, and as far as I can tell, they all lean one direction politically. Harry Styles
is great. You know.
He's just awesome. No, let's not get into it now, but I think that Civil War and Winter Soldier could be... The P might be a capital P in those as well.
I agree. I agree.
But I'm just saying, the dickheads.
I'm just saying it's not arguable in the other direction this time in any sense, in my mind. So I really like that. I think the character development for Spider-Man and his friends is great. Like, MJ actually has a character. I don't think this film passes Bechdel, but I do think she's a great character in her own right.
Bechdel's fantastic in this movie.
Okay. And just the whole class gets something to do. It's not just them. There's a bit more Flash. There's lots of Ned.
And a bit more
Fazoom. Betty. It's a gorgeous little class trip.
I'm intrigued to get into this with you on the spoiler special because I actually thought that people might have a problem with how little there is of the other characters, because John Watts makes a very interesting decision that we are with Peter the entire time. And I'm pretty sure that's the same thing in Homecoming as well. Like, every scene revolves around Peter. It is from his POV. When other characters come into it, they're coming into Peter's POV. They're coming into his world. And it's very much the same here as well. For example, not to give spoilers, this isn't a spoiler, we don't really see scenes where Ned goes off and does his thing. He doesn't have a subplot. We don't really see scenes where we're going off with MJ and we're getting to explore her, or we're getting to know her with her. Everything is seen through the prism of Peter.
But at the same time, they're given characters. They're given desires that are separate from Peter. They're not just there to impress Peter. They have their own concerns going on, which I just really, really like.
Cool.
Martin Starr is great as well as their teacher again.
He's so funny.
He's such a sad sack.
Yeah. One of my favorite MCU supporting characters.
Yeah.
Pretty much on the basis of this movie alone. He's very, very, very funny. So there will be a Spider-Man Far From Home spoiler special, which will feature interviews with director John Watts, producer Kevin Feige, and producer Amy Pascal, doing her very first ever spoiler special podcast.
This is cool.
This is very, very cool.
Can I also say, this should go without saying in a Marvel movie, but you stayed till the very end of the credits.
There is no leaving
in the middle of the credits, people.
Absolutely. And there is a lot of stuff to talk about.
A lot of stuff to talk about.
And very excited as well, guys, to see where this comes in our MCU ranking, which we're also doing next week. So that's going to be...
I've seen it three times now.
Same.
And every single time I've waited until the very end because I want to hear everyone else lose their shit in the post credits.
That actually happened last night.
Yeah, yeah, really.
I went to see it last night.
People will have physical and audible reactions to those post credit scenes.
It is a glorious thing to see.
In fact, skip the movie and then just time as you come in for the last 10 minutes. No?
No.
No. Okay. Not. Anyway, 4 stars then for Spider-Man Far From Home. And you know what? Fuck it. We might review it again next week.
Yay.
Why not? We'll just keep reviewing it until the end of time. Let's talk about Midsommar. And I'm going to step back here because I haven't seen it. You guys have?
I have, yes.
You have? That's good. It's always a good start when we're reviewing a film.
I have seen, I have experienced, I have not shaken off Midsommar.
That is the correct reaction. So this is obviously the new film from Ari Aster, who made Hereditary and scarred us all for life last summer. This time, we start with the story of Dani, who's played by Florence Pugh, and she experiences a tragedy in her life. She's a college student, maybe a PhD student, I'm not quite clear. Anyway, college student, and she experiences this tragedy, and as a result, her boyfriend, who was kind of thinking about breaking up with her, and she was kind of thinking he would, he's played by Jack Grainer, they decide to stay together. He doesn't feel that the time is right, understandably. And then he invites her with his friends to Europe. One of their friends is a Swedish exchange student. They're all going back to visit his home in Sweden for the summer festival. And she tags along as well. And then it becomes gradually clear that, you know, this is not a guy who, you know, just happens to know about a really cool pop concert in Stockholm. They are going to the middle of nowhere, quite far north in the country. So it's kind of endless daytime. This is a very daytime horror to the extent it is.
Yes.
And these kids are not in for what they expected. They're sort of intruding into or being invited into a very strange community with their own very particular traditions that may or may not, turn deadly.
Yeah, they're not in for what they think they're in for. They're in for what we think they're in for as the audience going,
absolutely.
Don't go to the festival. What are you doing?
And what's interesting here is basically nobody really lies to them. I mean, they leave some stuff out, but they don't actually lie about what's in store. And these people go along anyway, thinking everything will be fine, and it's kind of not. It's an extraordinarily beautiful film. I would be amazed if you see a more beautiful film this year. I would also be amazed if you see a grosser film this year.
There is some crazy gore in this.
This is 18 rated for its gore.
Yeah. And the amount of stuff that you can get away with these days, at 18, you have to really push the boundaries. And there are images that are continually brought up on the screen that you're like, oh, no, I didn't need to see that again. Mm-hmm. So I'd say go with a strong stomach.
Yeah.
It didn't hit me in the same way that Hereditary did.
No, because it's not actually scary in a weird way.
No, it's kind of horrifying.
Yes.
But it's not scary. And even for me with Hereditary, though...
Isn't that the point of a horror film?
With Hereditary, though, for me, it wasn't the sort of more traditionally horror-y stuff at the end that got me. It was the big thing a third of the way through and how emotionally distressing and the sheer harrowing... horror-filled weight of that.
Yeah.
That this doesn't quite...
But this isn't trying to do that.
Explore that in that way.
Yeah, this isn't, I think, trying to do that. It's trying to do something very, very, very different. So I agree with you. I think Hereditary, it's... For the first third of the film, it does feel like it's a horror. It does feel like that creeping dread. Mm-hmm. And then there's that thing that happens, and that throws everything for a loop. But you're still kind of... You still kind of got the dread by that point because it's kind of embedded. Mm. In this one, even though you know bad things are happening and you're dreading them happening... you don't kind of have that build. You don't kind of have that kind of catharsis almost of the moments that you think you're going to see. So it's in a weird way, very, very horrifying and not really scary, but at the same time really sticks with you, really haunts you and is very, very impactful. And I think is exactly the film that you set out to make. It's very, very successful that way, but it's maybe not the film you expect to see. It's an odd beast, but not a bad one.
And especially because you're not going to expect this to be funny, but I laughed loads and it's very deadpan. Even in its most horrific moments, it's kind of, there is a sort of deadpan humor at play. Even in the kind of the big first major horrific thing that happens, there's also an underlying element where it is like weirdly comic in a way. And I think it treads that line in a really interesting way.
Yeah. Two questions from an idiot who hasn't seen it.
Sure.
Where does this stand in terms of the torture porn genre?
It's not torture porn at all.
Okay.
I mean, again, horrific things happen, but not in a torture porny, drawn out sort of way.
Okay. So, for example, it's not like it doesn't have, it's not a close cousin of, it sounds to me a little bit like it's a close cousin of some of those cannibal movies from the 70s or something like Eli Roth's The Green Inferno. No, not at all.
No.
I've also seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre cited as a.
I can see why, just in the setup, I think, you know, a small group of students coming to a remote location, and also the kind of the beauty of the way that that was sometimes filmed, especially those final shots, and also the sheer amount of gore. Mm-hmm. But also, no, it's not what would spring to mind. Obviously, The Wicker Man's been cited by a lot of people, and it, as much as what to kind of avoid sticking too close to as a... you know, what it's like. But at the same time, I think this is very much its own beast at the end of the day. And its concern is not with the thing you think it's with. The story it's trying to tell ultimately, and I don't want to get into spoilers, but the story it's trying to tell ultimately, I don't think is the story you think you're watching. So I don't want to say too much more than that.
Can we just say Florence Pugh? I know everything Florence Pugh is in, you come out and go, oh, Florence Pugh is amazing. Yeah. But you come out of this like, oh my God, Florence Pugh is amazing.
Yeah.
She's so great. You really understand every conflicting emotion that her character is going through the whole way through. And she, yeah, she's extraordinary.
And full credit, I think, to the whole cast. And, you know, not just her, but the, you know, the friendly Swedish cultists are very friendly and very nice.
Very Swedish.
Yeah. You know, Will Poulter is the kind of obnoxious mate that your boyfriend has that you kind of have to hang out with because he's your boyfriend's best mate. But Jesus, he's annoying.
Yeah, we've talked about how he is. He's a dick.
Yeah.
He's just a dick.
And Chidi's in it as well. William Jackson Harper. So all really, really good actors, basically.
Does he do his Chidi face? Like kind of,
do you know what? He's very, very separate from Chidi, despite also being a kind of academic.
Almost like he's an actor playing characters or something.
He's definitely not in The Good Place.
Five stars then, because Nick Desemlian reviewed this and he lost his shit for this movie. Five stars for Midsommar, which is, I believe, a recommendation.
I would say so.
For the right person, it's a recommendation. Yeah.
Yes. Maybe don't double bill it with Spider-Man Far From Home, but perhaps do double bill it with another five-star horror classic, which is out this week, re-released in cinemas across the country, which is Nick Rogue's Don't Look Now. And
it's
just
a stunning film.
Incredible film. And don't want to go into too much, but one of the most iconic... Well, so much about this movie is iconic. Iconic exploration of grief and loss and...
marriage.
Also set in Venice.
Yeah.
Like bits of Spider-Man Far From Home. It's up to you to decide which movie you think is the best.
So what you do is you triple bill, you start with Spider-Man, and then when you've got Venice in your head, you go into Don't Look Now, and then when you're like, oh, I really need some more like emotional, grief-stricken horror, you go into Midsommar.
That's
going to be a really topsy-turvy day for you.
That's going to be a killer.
Iconic ending, iconic... lovemaking scene, I think we can call it. All sorts of stuff going on there. It is one of the true horror greats. So check out Don't Look Now. If you haven't already seen it on the big screen, then do try and make time to do it. So this week, five stars for that one as well. And that is it.
Wow.
On that bombshell, that is it for this very, very long episode of the Empire Podcast. But the Will Poulter interview is quite short. So it all works out. It all balances. It's all part of the great balance. It's what Thanos would call a perfect podcast.
No.
No?
No. Guarantee you not.
Oh, it's a shame. It's a real shame. I'm really aiming for the Thanos market at the moment. It's a very lucrative market.
Is it?
Well, it used to be. Anyway, join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by... I have no idea.
Oh my God, I love him.
I have genuinely no idea who's going to be joining us in next week's show. And that makes it all the more fun for me. So...
Cool.
In the unlikely event that you are an A-list star and you happen to be in London next week and you have some time to spare, then just drop me a line. DM me at Chris Hewitt on Twitter And that's talk. That's my people will talk to your people and we'll make this happen.
I haven't had a chance to talk on the podcast about seeing Henry Cavill and his giant dog in a pub in London, which happened a couple of weeks ago. And it was like the best thing that's ever happened to me.
That sounds like the best thing that's ever happened.
He was great, but his dog was amazing.
How giant are we talking? Are we talking Clifford the Big Red Dog?
It's like a big sort of kind of husky esque,
like a bear for thing. any other man. But yeah, for Henry Cavill,
it's a chihuahua.
Yeah.
And they were just having a Friday night in the pub, as was I separately.
What, was the dog at a table with them? Like
they
just having a beer.
They were at a table. And the main, it was more like, oh my god, have you seen that giant dog? Oh, there's Henry Cavill. Then like, oh my god, there's Henry Cavill. Also a giant dog.
I mean, he's delightful, but also dogs.
Did you speak to Henry Cavill?
I did the whole, like, I obviously know who you are, but I'm not going to be like, oh, it's you. I'm just going to be like, oh, is this your dog? Oh, it's really lovely. This is great. Have a nice evening. And then the dog was just, like, lying on the floor next to me in the pub. So obviously I had to go over and stroke it again.
Was he a good boy?
Oh, he was such a good boy. Such a good boy. Extremely well behaved.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
It's a super dog.
Yeah. Best thing is, its name is actually Cal.
Oh, no way!
Yeah, his name was Cal, with a K.
Oh, that's lovely.
Oh, it was, apart from the time I almost physically bumped into Paul McCartney and was so shocked that I couldn't do anything about it, it's the best celebrity spot I've ever had in London.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was great. The Empire WhatsApp group was on fire that night.
It really was. Yeah. So the pub is the Fortress of Solitude, and if you want to check it out, that's pretty awesome. Why the hell didn't you get talking to him, become friends with him, and then we could have just had him on the podcast next week?
Oh. I mean, come on,
we
Ben.
Could have finally had the conversation about the Justice League that we weren't able to have when I interviewed him on this podcast about fucking Justice League. So we could have done that. And it's your fault, Ben.
I'm sorry.
Get out.
Fine. I'm not kidding. We're finishing up. This is the end of the podcast.
I don't care if we go 30 seconds wrong.
No,
I want you to leave, Ben. Wait, why are you leaving? Ben.
I'm done. I'm out. I don't need this.
All right.
I'm back. No, coming back.
Yeah, come back. There he goes. I could never throw Ben out. Look at him.
Oh, look at his face.
I'm back.
Anyway, until next week, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion again, please do get in touch if you're an A-list. I will accept B-list.
Oh my God.
I'm not picky.
So generous.
I'm not picky. I may even, as the week goes on, drop down to C-list. Okay?
Come on, Chris.
All right. If you have a face and I've vaguely heard of you, then please do get in touch.
Hang on. This week, the Advertising Standards Authority claim that anyone with 30,000 Twitter followers is a celebrity. So your options are pretty open.
Our guest in next week's podcast is podcaster, broadcaster, journalist, writer, and guy with, I don't know, MDE? I don't want to speak for him, but Chris Hewitt will be our guest on the podcast next week. Very much looking forward to that guy. He has a lot of incendiary things to say. Let's just put it that way. Until we meet again, it is goodbye from Ben Travis.
Goodbye.
Get out, Ben.
I will leave of my own accord.
Okay, fair enough. It is goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I am off, not just to the play that goes wrong, but also to the Harry Potter tour tomorrow.
Oh, it's so good.
Enjoy it. It's my favorite place.
So I might try and hit that Buckbeak. So next week's guest might be Buckbeak. Who knows? Find out next week if my attempt is successful. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.